Whether this is her first Mother's Day or her 40th, she deserves more. Shop tons of stunning on-trend jewelry for every budget at Diamonds Direct. Diamond fashion jewelry, beautiful birthstones, everyday pearls, starting at just $200. Commemorate the real loves of her life with a gorgeous pendant featuring the birthstone of the one who made her mom. This Mother's Day, Diamonds Direct is everything you need to say thank you. Diamonds Direct, your love, our passion. Online at DiamondsDirect.com.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Family Secrets is a production of iHeartRadio.
Hi, Family Secrets family. It's Danny. Last week, I had the pleasure of being part of an ongoing series produced by Penguin Random House called Two Writers Talking. The writers in this case were myself and Bob Kolker, author of the blockbuster Hidden Valley Road. Bob and I were moderated by New York Times journalist and critic Jennifer Senior. The subject? You guessed it, family secrets. I'm excited to share this special bonus episode with you. And remember, April 1st, we'll be dropping a whole new season. Between now and then, though, we have a few surprises in store, so keep your eyes and ears out.
What were you most responsive to in each other's books? And they may or may not have had to do with secrecy.
I'm happy to go first, if that's great. All right. Thank you, Danny, for the chance to talk with you about your book. I really was blown away by it. I thought that the part about it that really struck me was the sort of the two reactions that you had to this news about your biological heritage. The first thing you do is you look in the mirror and you wonder if you're still yourself. You know, if this, you're wondering how this news actually changes you. And then the ripple effects start and you start to wonder if the information was there all along and you only willed it away. You know, that remark your mother made several years earlier, why didn't you see that? And several other clues that you almost willfully didn't notice. And I recognize that in the family I reported on in Hidden Valley Road. You have children who learn more and more secrets as they get older. The mother in the book, Mimi Galvin, she tends to let loose new pieces of information when her back is against the wall. So the revelations keep coming into her 90s. And after a while, they're so whipsawed by all the new information, they start to wonder if, in certain cases, there are things they should have known all along, if they really had been trying to assemble a narrative. And it's this assembling of your own personal narrative that interests me the most and how fragile it can be.
Bob, I had a very similar response reading Hidden Valley Road and thinking about the ways in which I loved. I cried multiple times, especially toward the end. The sisters, the two youngest children, the only girls in the family, are, I think, the ones who grapple most, each in their own way, with what they didn't know, what they might have known, what each of them, you know, there's a conversation that they have fairly, not early, but like in the middle of the book, where one asks the other, "Did this happen to you too?" I don't know, spoilers, but you know, "Did this happen to you too?" And the answer is, "No, I have no idea what you're talking about." And then way later, as adults, they have the same conversation again, and the answer, of course, is yes. And the sister who was asked that doesn't even remember being asked that. And so there's this way in which I think that family secrets, or secrets in general, the toxicity of them renders them, like Jung calls secrets psychic poison, right? So it renders them something that we may know on some level, but can't touch. And the family in Hidden Valley Road is full of so many secrets that ricochet off of each other and can't touch each other. And, you know, in my case, inheritance is a memoir, and it's my own story. But because I have written 9 books prior, I actually have a body of evidence for what I actually knew but couldn't think, because it's in my fiction, it's in my earlier memoirs, it's like the thing that was always there that I was digging for without knowing that I was digging. I really did not consciously know it, but I now see there was a trail of breadcrumbs.
Danny, what was that term that you had, the psychoanalytic term, unthought?
The unthought known.
Unthought known.
Coined by a psychoanalyst named Christopher Bolas, who's written a great deal about it. The unthought known, which is just one of my favorite phrases ever, I think, is really defines what we absolutely in our gut, you know, in our, you know, we know it, but we can't think it because it's too dangerous.
So you mentioned that Jung, who, by the way, had a psychotic break and may, in fact, have been schizophrenic himself, which is an interesting through line through all of the. You mentioned that Jung talked about, called secrets psychic poison. They're good for books, though, right? I mean, I feel like some of the best literature is about deceit, if not all of it. And so I am wondering if you, before we dive into your books, if you have favorite books about deceit, and if you think secrets are at least useful in helping structure a narrative, you know, I mean, if you were looking to the anything in particular?
They certainly offer a surprise ending sometimes. in Danny's case, a surprise beginning in Inheritance, but the sort of like the end of a mystery. You know, hindsight's 20/20, but I look back on many years of magazine writing and writing, you know, crime stories, and I see more and more stories about families in crisis, and quite often with information that's been tamped down because of scandal and then comes out again because of the narrative that I'm writing about. So, you know, I wrote about a young man who was on trial for a gay hate crime. And in the middle of the trial, he stands up and declares that he himself is gay. He comes out of the closet and reveals his secret. And one woman's life being molested by her father culminates with her murdering her father and then going on trial, so that the secret she couldn't keep closed up forever. I think about it a lot in terms of its narrative power, but and I see it everywhere. When I started reporting on the Galvins, I thought about American Pastoral, which, you know, has a family calamity that feels so hard to explain, but it's also quite scandalous and secrets are kept. And then the parents, or the father in particular, is searching, you know, what is it, you know, in the past that might have caused this? What secret relationship with his daughter might have triggered this? I think it's an effort to find clarity and an effort to write the story. You know, I had listened to a bonus episode of Family Secrets with Bessel van der Kolk, who is no relation to Kolker. And but he said something that really, really hit me about, and I'm going to mangle it, but it's about trauma as a story that can't be written. So the you know, your effort to write your book and the Galvin's determination to tell their story is to me, it's a way of moving through trauma and to try to give it, if not a happy ending, at least to help it settle down a little bit.
I love that. And the Bessel's, the quote is, it's the nature of trauma that it doesn't allow a story to be told, which is why when we're traumatized by something, all of us, our first instinct is to tell the story again and again and again to whoever will listen, because we're trying to contain it, and it's like water like running through our open fingers. It feels impossible. And of course, you know, narrative ultimately, like finding a way to shape trauma into art, you know, or, you know, chaos into some kind of, you know, shape or clarity is the work of literature and the work of life, I think. But, you know, people ask me all the time about family secrets and my podcast and my, like, do I go hunting? Do I go searching for my guests? And, you know, I don't, because the stories keep on coming, and they are very often wonderful books that either I find them, I read them, I know them, or the authors are friends of mine, and I suddenly think, oh, that would be Nick Flynn, that would be an amazing story, or Jenny Boylan, that would be an amazing story, or T. Kira Madden, that would be an amazing story, K.S.A. Lehman, that would be, we could go on. I mean, it's why there are so many writers on my show. It's not because it's a literary podcast. It's because the work, I think, that writers do of finding a way to take a secret, a trauma, multiple secrets, multiple traumas, and shape them so that then, you know, what we have is not only the mess, but the transcendence, you know, the redemption in some way from that, the turning it into something that has meaning and that will have meaning for others.
That actually, excuse me, it's funny, written right on my sheet here as the next thing that I wanted to ask you is, what do you think the hardest thing is about writing about family secrets? Like what makes it, what are the biggest challenges? And I think that each of you are going to have very different answers. Obviously, Bob, you were trying to earn the confidence of the family, and you are, Danny, this is very personal to you. So Bob, I mean, do you want to go first? I mean, it's going to be idiosyncratic, and it's going to vary from story to story and what vantage point you're telling it from, obviously. But for you in this project, Bob, what was it?
I certainly believe the stakes for Danny must have been very personal and very high as you're writing about friends and loved ones. Whereas with me, I'm encountering these sisters who are the first people I met in the family, who are determined to be transparent. They want to smash all the secrets to bits. They want to be in the open. But I am, you know, I'm not them. I'm a reporter. And so I need to make sure that they trust me. But more importantly, I need to talk to everybody in the family to make sure that I'm telling an accurate and fair story. And that took a year before I even got the book deal, talking to various family members, because I was very skeptical. I was convinced that one family member at least would stand up and say, "You've got to be kidding me. I don't want my family secrets in a book." And I hadn't been prepared for just how much the rest of the family would defer to the sisters, and also how optimistic they were that they had something to tell the world about the science of mental illness and about how they move through their traumas as a family. So I was happily surprised when they did it. But the biggest risk is that you betray that trust, or that you skew it in some way where it quite clearly is a self-serving work of journalism. I had to be removed enough from the situation so that I didn't write something too completely flimsy, but I also wanted to report as intimately as possible about these people's thoughts and feelings. So that was my challenge.
Bob, can I ask you why you think that they all really did come on board? That's so unusual that they all did. Was it out of a kind of sense of duty in a way to the two sisters, or was it also as you touched upon, like in the name of science, that there was this extraordinary opportunity to, you know, for the world to learn something about schizophrenia.
And can I just jump on and also say, was there, I can't remember anymore, who was the toughest cell, if there was a toughest cell?
I mean, there were three or four things. The first was that most of the horrible events in the family had happened 30 or years ago or more. So I hadn't really considered how long ago the events were. The second was deferring to the sisters, who were the youngest in the family. And so older brothers who had left the house earlier felt guilty, frankly, that so much had trickled down and things that they never knew happened had happened to the sisters. Family secrets had happened to the sisters. And so they said, okay, if they want it, then that's fine. And then there was late-breaking scientific information about the family's genetic code. Two different groups of researchers found out two different things that were really stunning all at the same time. And then finally, the big one is that Mimi, the mother, was on board for the first time. She was not interested for a very long time, but she was around 90 now and in very frail health. And everybody thought it was now or never. And I think the scientific breakthroughs were very validating to her. It made her, you know, it made her feel comfortable saying this was genetic, this wasn't my fault. And so she was fine talking to me about what she wanted to talk about with me.
What was toughest for you? I mean, Nanny, this is going to be a very different, I can't even imagine. Yeah.
And there were a couple of different layers. Both of my parents were gone. And people have sometimes asked me how I think the story might have been different if my parents were alive or if one of them had been alive. If my father had still been living, there wouldn't be a book. I just wouldn't have written it while he was living. He, I believe, very much wanted this to stay buried. It was something both of my parents were going to take to the grave with them, and they did. And then I remember when Inheritance was about to come out, and the first piece that was published was in Time magazine, and it was a big thing. And there was this photograph of my dad and me on the beach, happy, like playful, loving photograph. And when the piece came out, I had such a pang because I thought, like, that young father, if he could have had a crystal ball and seen a future where this secret that I think was so deep that he perhaps was even keeping it from himself, that would have been there in a magazine that he read, you know, religiously every week, there for all the world to see. I was just very aware of that was painful for me, but it also felt to me in terms of like, well, what right do I have to tell this story? I have grappled with that in other books. With Inheritance, I never grappled with it because it literally felt like the story of my life. Like this was that I had a right to tell it and to explore it and to, you know, go deeply as a journalist into, you know, who were my parents before I was born and what was the world that they lived in. But the other piece of it was I discovered my biological father, and this is not a spoiler. I mean, he had been an anonymous sperm donor as a 22-year-old medical student and was very conscious of his privacy, as was I. And from the time that he and I started having any contact with each other, it was very clear that I was going to write a book about this. I mean, it was the book that everything else had led to. And I was transparent about that with my biological father and with his family that I, you know, his wife and the kids that I was in touch with. But when I promised that I would protect his identity, and I worked very hard to protect his identity. When I finished the manuscript and before it started going down the pipeline toward being published, I did something that is such a memoir 101, you don't do this, but I had to, which was I sent it to him and I asked him to read it really for a sense. I wanted to know that he felt that I hadn't missed anything, that there was no little tell in there where somebody who really wanted to and became obsessed could figure out who he was. But I think I was also looking for his blessing, which I received from him. I received an extraordinary long letter back from him after he had read it with a list of all the things that he liked, some of which were things that were very tough in the book, but really saying, I feel that you've been fair. This reflects my experience too. And he felt that his identity had been protected. So that was this piece of that process that was very different for me, because even with my own mother, when she was living and I published earlier memoirs, I did not submit them to her for her approval before they came out.
I love the part in your book where you infer, I'm sure correctly, that they've Googled you. You know, your biological father and his family, that they all, and I just imagine, you know, with a smile, them saying, oh my God, she's going to write about this. You know, there's totally. No way she's not going to write about this, which kind of puts the brakes on everything for a little while.
Yeah. I mean, I think initially when I think the reticence about having any contact with me was like Oprah could be lurking in the bushes and jumping out with a camera crew. Yeah. It was like, wow, this is great. She's a writer. How interesting. Oh, this is terrible. She writes about her family and identity. And yeah.
Although I had this thought that like that happened and then they started reading you and they were like, oh, but maybe this will be wonderful. And maybe this will be just the thing, you know?
Yeah. He clearly is won over. Like he understands how everything is so well considered in your writing. So he gets it.
Yet it's complicated. Right? Mm-hmm. Because what does it mean to be, and I was very aware of this when the book came out, you know, he was just about 80 when the book came out and this very private person. And it was kind of, you know, it was kind of hard to miss. He would turn on the TV or there would be a magazine or these things I think were a little intense because it was also a story that was in a way part of his story too. But he was certainly choosing anonymity and I was offering it. So on a human level, he and I have spoken about it, but we'll never speak about it publicly, I don't think. But it's just an interesting thing to grapple with. And we were all Googling each other like mad.
Meanwhile, your father, like the man who brought you up, is all over inheritance. You know, it's dedicated to him. Your relationship with him and your new thoughts on how will you relate to him now that you have this news? It's something you wrestle with so openly and cogently all the way through. It really, I feel like it keeps coming back to him. It's another part that really struck me.
Thank you. Yeah. And when people ask me, the dedication page of Inheritance is it's books dedicated to my father. And I don't specify which father, because of course I didn't specify which father. Of course it should be apparent that I have one father. I have one dad, and that's the dad who raised me. But people would bring that up, and I'm like, no, that's the whole point.
Can I just point something out? You said, of course it should be apparent. That's no. I mean, it's just one of these weird oral accidents. That's not an accident. The you were talking to. This is going to apply to both of you, and I think it's going to be the final question actually before we go on and look at some of the audience questions. But so, Danny, you obviously went to extraordinary lengths to make sure that you know your biological father was comfortable with this, and you probably had some instinctive sense of what you owed him. What do you think we owe the people who actually in our families who might deceive us? Like, what do we owe them? That's got to be a question you've wrestled with. And Bob, certainly the two youngest sisters had very different approaches to what they believed they owed their families. So I think I'll leave it on that. I think it's.
And Danny, you also are now you're an aficionado of family secret stories. You've talked with a couple dozen people now who've been through revelations and found new ways to relate with their family. In the case of the Galvins, in the beginning, I met the sisters together, and I thought that perhaps this would be a story about two sisters who huddled together and made it through a very difficult childhood, that they could be some of the people we would root for in this story as they grow up. And then once I interviewed them separately, I found that they were quite different people, that they had had many years of closeness and then many years of not so closeness, that they had been through very similar traumas as children, but had processed them differently. And I was thrown by it for a moment or two. But then I sat up and said, this is reality. Different people experience their families in different ways. I have a sister and brother who might be watching on the Zoom now. You know, we grew up in the same house, but in different houses. You know, and we have different memories that each of which are probably self-serving. And so when the privilege I had in writing the Galvin story is to be able to write about these women's lives over decades and also their brothers, and to see how their perceptions of their family change and how the way they decide to relate to their family changes. Lindsay starts out wanting to leave and never come back. She ends up coming back and being the caregiver for her brothers. You know, Margaret grabs her chance to escape the trauma and then feels a certain amount of rejection and ambivalence about what happened. She feels a little locked out, and that colors her relationship with her family going forward. And she decides, once all the secrets spill out, that becomes further fuel for her to declare some boundaries and some independence, a little like Tara Westover in Educated. So I see two different models in the book that I was really very pleased to be able to portray year by year almost as they move through their lives.
Yeah, I was so struck by that, by the tracking of their different experiences. And, you know, like if you were tracking them as a novelist and if this were fiction, I think a novelist might have come up with a very different response in each of those women as adults, and or maybe a great novelist would have come up with exactly the response that happened. But, you know, one of the things in having become sort of a student of family secrets unexpectedly, is that one of the things I've learned, especially in the podcast, is that when we discover something is at least as important as what we discover, like how these things break over the course of our lives. I had a moment that really took me aback as I was researching and reporting and processing my own experience, where I thought, I had felt so betrayed by my parents initially. I felt like, how could you have kept this a secret? It's like such a fundamental human right to know if it's possible to know where, you know, where we come from. And then at some point I realized, well, what would have happened to me if I had learned this at 16 or at 23? What if my mother had blurted it out to me after my father died? When that was a time in my life where I was a hot mess of a human being, and I don't think I would have survived it. I found out what I found out at an extremely stable time in my life, you know, when in a long time marriage and with a child who was already 17 at the time I made this discovery. In midlife, I had a lot of life behind me with a very solid foundation. And so I end up feeling like I found out at a really miraculous moment where there was enough time, still enough people living who I might be able to learn something from. I also hear stories from people regularly who are making these kinds of discoveries and they're in their 80s. What do you do with that? With the time that's left and what there is to process. So I think it has a lot to do with the when and not only with the what.
I'm also reminded of something you said in your book, Danny, where you said that sometimes family secrets are they're kept out of love.
We're going to take a quick break here for a word from our sponsor.
At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. Whether your pursuit involves a bachelor's, master's, or doctoral degree, GCU's learning environments are designed for supportive networking and collaboration. With over 330 academic programs, GCU provides a path to help you fulfill your dreams.
The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
I'm going to go into Q&A function here. What does Bob believe is the biggest obstacle to progress in the treatment of schizophrenia?
Well, there have been some strides in early intervention, and a little bit of the stigma is gone now so that families aren't blamed for the disease. There is family support now if you're lucky enough to have good health care. So those have improved. But for a variety of reasons, it's just there's been very little movement on the pharmaceutical front. I mean, I came up in an era where when you think about mental illness, I thought of it as a brain chemistry issue, and that the idea was to, through hard work and trial and error and the right therapist and psychopharmacologist, you'd find the right pill that would perhaps help you become more functional. And that might be true for things like anxiety or depression, but schizophrenia is still working with the same basic drugs that the Galvin family were treated with back in the late 60s and early 70s. And that part is hard. And there are a lot of reasons for that. One is some disappointing outcomes from the Human Genome Project. Instead of finding one big genetic issue that could be zapped with the drug, they've found more than 100 potential variants that all have very limited effect size. So it's hard to know what gene to zap with a pharmaceutical drug. And then also, you can't really test it on mice. You have to test it on humans, and that's risky and expensive. And then finally, the constituency can't really advocate for themselves the same way that people with cancer can, for instance. And so things are sluggish in all of those fronts.
I just found one for Danny that I think is really kind of great. What questions would you ask your father and mother knowing what you do now?
I would ask how conscious they were of what they were signing on for, what they were doing in going to an institute and using donor sperm. I'm fascinated by that time in reproductive medicine where so many people who wanted to be parents were deceived, though often with the best of intentions, by by the doctors that they went to see who really believed it would be best if they forgot it ever happened. I wonder how closely they kept that knowledge in their consciousness. In Family Secrets, the tagline of every episode is, the secrets that are kept from us, the secrets we keep from others, and the secrets we keep from ourselves. I wonder which of those categories my parents fell into and what that meant for the three of us, what that meant for the way that we interacted with each other during my childhood.
Celeste would like to know, hi, Robert. Thanks so much for your amazing work, which I'm passing around to other psychiatry residents. What she wanted to know was, how did the Galvins react? What was the response?
Well, there came a point a couple months before the book came out when People magazine wanted to write a feature about the family and to put a small excerpt in it. And so I was getting on the phone with Amal saying, hey, can you meet a reporter? And I that's when I said to myself, you know, I can't ask them to take time out of their day and to do all of this with a book they haven't even read. So a couple months before it came out, I did send advanced copies to them. And I think that there was relief that I delivered what I said I would, which is something that dealt with the tender and sensitive issues of their family, of the family secrets, in a way that wasn't like rubbernecking, that was tasteful. And that was really about the possible good that the family could do. And then there were individual difficulties that some of them had with placement. You know, this was a group portrait of a family with some people foregrounded and some people backgrounded. You know, I was here too at that dinner. Why wasn't I, you know, why didn't you talk to, why aren't my thoughts and feelings about that in there? And so I think that is the inherent difficulty with journalism in general, but also with intimately reported narrative journalism, that the reporter ends up being the one who makes the calls. And they were kind enough to give up that control to someone and trust in them. But then something amazing happened, which is Oprah's book club. And that kind of set everyone's mind at ease in the family about how this book would be received in the world. The last thing they wanted was for it to be something tawdry or something that would be kind of like a grisly, gross book. And so as soon as Oprah's book club accepted the book and started to flag the book, everyone, including myself, we all kind of, you know, had a sigh of relief saying, we know that it will be seen as a product with goodwill. And that was important.
Did it alter their dynamics at all? I'm just curious.
I mean, I think it gave them jet fuel to do the things that they always wanted to do. Lindsay, the youngest, is now a very active advocate for rights for the mentally ill, for advocating for families who are dealing with acutely mentally ill family members. She's joined the boards of two different organizations and she's looking to join a third. She's very active. And then Margaret has doubled down on her artwork, has pulled away for now from her regular family and is, you know, sort of come close to her immediate family and her chosen family. And she is counseling people on how to move through trauma in her own one-on-one way. These are things that I think they were on their way to doing. If you've read to the end of the book, these are things they've wanted to do for a while, but the book has sort of given them permission to do it. It's done, I hope, I'd like to think on a good day that it's done that thing that Bessel van der Kolk talked about, that it's written the thing that they couldn't write themselves so that they can feel that the story is somewhat complete and they can go to the next chapter.
And Bob, isn't there the next generation, the grandchildren who, I mean, that was one of the things that when I said your book made me cry, that was, I can identify that as a place where it really did. The idea that this is, one of the things about Family Secrets is when you can actually own your story, you know, you own the whole thing and all of its messiness and all of its complexity. And that was something that, and you can't do that when it's a secret. When it's a secret, all it is toxic poison leaking over everything and creating all sorts of behaviors in ways that people can't, you know, they don't even know why they're behaving in the way that they are. And so the fact that this was so in the open, ultimately, in this family is also, it would seem to me, what allowed those grandchildren to start owning it as well.
Yes. but I hope I also hit it some of the mixed blessing of that, that Lindsay was so interested in not hiding things, so interested in transparency, wanted her children to know so much that they ended up assuming some of the burden she carried and felt a little scarred themselves. So I was, you know, it never gets simple. It might get better, but it definitely, it doesn't get wrapped up in a bow. Although there was a very lovely little moment at the end with Lindsay's daughter that I won't reveal here.
Before I go to Danny, you know, that reminds me of a question that I didn't ask you, but that has to do with the idea of, at any given time, I think when people are keeping secrets, Danny, you actually cautioned against this. You said, we shouldn't be guilty of presentism. We shouldn't hold people in the past accountable to present day standards of moral and ethical behavior, because they were probably doing the best they can and they were doing as they were counseled. So the Galvins may have been, you know, sort of behaving the way they thought they were supposed to behave. Your parents probably thought it was in your interest to keep this stuff a secret. I'm very interested in how, and you both wrote with tremendous compassion about your respective families, one that you were reporting on and one that was your own. How did you manage to drum up that kind of compassion? Were there previous versions where you were kind of angrier, Danny, and you kind of had to hit select all, delete? And, you know, Bob, were there, you know, moments where you held out the matriarch Mimi with more contempt and then kind of toned it back? Just curious. Because transparency, of course, now seems like the right and ethical thing to do. But as Bob was pointing out, that can also backfire. We don't know if, you know, obviously you want to err on the side of sharing. I mean, transparency is good, but it can have its, you know, too much could also be harmful. So I'm just curious.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I did hit control, whatever that thing is.
Select all, delete.
Like, yeah, but for 200 pages, because I didn't yet have the necessary distance. You know, there's a very, very slight, but very, very necessary distance between myself and the story as I was telling it. And I think one of the gifts of writing the book is that I developed more and more ever-deepening compassion for both of my parents as I was writing it, because my reporting was leading me to these places where I understood what it must have been to be an infertile, childless couple in the early 1960s in their milieu, and the shame and the, you know, the distress of that. It must have felt to them like the absolute end of the world. And so when you are faced with the absolute end of the world, you know, you take desperate measures. And I'm sure this felt like a desperate measure to them. But the gift was, and I think I do write this in the book, we don't often have the need or the desire or the circumstances to really be able to empathically imagine our parents as people, aside from being our parents, who they were before us. We just don't do it. They're our parents, and that's just not something, it's not a place where we go. And I had to go there in order to be able to walk with them, like walk that walk with them through that process. And that was a great gift.
Here, I think there's a lot of parallels with the part of the work that I was doing to try to discover the lives of Mimi and her husband, Don, the parents in the book, because there was archival work and there were interviews. And then there was, you know, really, really deep speculation about what their challenges might have been, and then interrogating those speculations to try to report them out. The mother, Mimi, was still around as I was reporting. She died in the middle of my work. But the father had died close to 20 years earlier. Many of the children started out in my early conversations, had many critical things to say about their mother. She was in a lot of denial. She preferred the sick children to the well ones. She put us in harm's way. But I was on high alert at that time, because I feel like mothers get a really raw deal in nonfiction and in fiction when you write about families. And I didn't want to necessarily run to her as a scapegoat. And sure enough, the more I talked with everyone, the more I saw that over time they understood the subtleties of what she was dealing with. And also she was the one who was dealing with it. The father, who everyone had put on a pedestal, actually wasn't so great. And Mimi, who had her hands dirty, making lots and lots of decisions, some of them bad, some of them good, you know, she wasn't so bad. And I wanted to get at that ambiguity and also avoid the presentism. I mean, the options this family had, like the options your parents had, were very, very narrow. And the stigma that your parents were dealing with and that this family were dealing with were, you know, considerable.
We'll be right back.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024, and we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you here on Next Question, it's going to be a good time the whole time, we hope. I have some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
You know, you start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question. Last question, I promise. You have to go. I have to go. But it's been so fun, and I can't wait for you to hear it. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danny, I liked a question that I saw here for you, which is from Tom. Did inheritance, which solves the secret, make you look at your earlier books any differently?
Oh, that's a great question.
I know. It's really a good question. Yeah.
Well, first of all, it made me revisit them, which, you know, you really don't necessarily want to revisit like a first novel that you wrote in 1990, you know, but I did. not for the faint-hearted. And what I feel reading my earlier work, I wondered at first whether inheritance would render all of my earlier work moot in some way. Like, you know, I had that kind of strange fear of, well, are those books now somehow inauthentic because I didn't know? And I wrote a great deal about my father, a great deal about my parents, a great deal about secrets, but I was missing this essential piece. I actually end up feeling like, not all of them, I mean, not the early novels, but they're more interesting to me now in a certain way, because every book is, I mean, certainly memoirs most of all, is like holding time still within the covers of a book. This is all I know now. It's going into this story. And I've always known that, which is why I've written multiple memoirs. But now I look back and I think, wow, that really is all I knew in 2010. And that was all I knew in 1998 and so forth. And so it actually makes for a really interesting kind of body of work. Someday I may try to do something with that, like annotate them, or like just because this past summer, I recorded the audiobook of Slow Motion, which is my first memoir that came out in 1998. It's never been an audiobook. So I was recording it and I had to stop so many times in the studio, just stunned by a sentence that I just read, realizing how much I knew, how much subconsciously was right there. So that's kind of thrilling in a way. They don't feel like I was mistaken. They just feel like that's what I knew then and this is what I know now.
If you wrote an essay about that, I just want to say I'd be here for that. I would read it. No, really, like just reviewing what the things that sort of jump off the page like crickets now that sort of tell you that you were dropping yourself clues.
And if you annotated an early book, to have it on audio would be fun too. Like, hey, hold the phone. Wait, whoa.
We need two narrators.
I was just going to say, they add the anxiety Danny narrate translator, like the Keegan Peele. Like, I'm not doing the right, but you know what I mean. Oh, this is nice. Robert, when I read a book like yours, I always think about Janet Malcolm's assertion that journalism is always an act of betrayal. Did you ever have a moment of doubting what you were doing? Did it affect your decisions as you were writing or in writing?
You know, there is a question of who are you working for, right? And I very specifically am not an advocacy journalist. I write books that reviewers seem to use the word empathy a lot, but I find the way I look at the word empathy is, you know, a certain amount of intimacy and the ability to walk in someone's shoes, but that's different from advocacy. And I'm right up against the line the entire time. So I kind of live in that Janet Malcolm world where some people might wonder, am I going to be betrayed by you? And I never make that promise that I will never betray them, because I am, after all, independent and I am not working for them. And so that's tough. It's a tough thing to do. And it often means that some people are just going to say no, they're not going to do it. And moments when I like to laugh at myself, I think like journalists are like vampires, like they only come where they're invited in, like they can't just like barge into the house. Someone actually has to let them in. And that's why I was so tentative with this family. I said, let's take months. Let me get on the phone once a week with a different member of the family and speak in an open-ended way about what you might expect from a book like this. And we'll all know one way or another at the end of 10 weeks, you know, whether this is possible or not. And if it isn't possible, I'll move on and do something else. And you have to be ready to walk away that way.
Danny, I'm going to end it. I think we have 2 minutes. So I'm going to end it with you. I'm going to take the liberty of summarizing a number of the questions here, which are kind of more comments than questions, but there's a theme running through them. A lot of people are saying, I was conceived by a sperm donor, or do you know anything about sperm donation laws in Georgia in the 1960s, all sorts of like very specific things. I'm wondering how much you've become, I can ask both of you this question, you know, but how much you've become people's confessors. It's an awesome responsibility to take on. And maybe what kind of repository of information you've become and, you know, what kind of function you serve for people now in this way.
I mean, I couldn't have imagined what happened when this book came out, and it happened from day one, from the very first event that I did, where I looked around at the room and I thought, who is everybody here? This is not my usual literary demographic. There were, you know, old men, and there were middle-aged couples, and there were young people, and there were people crying before I even opened my mouth. This period of time that we're in regarding people discovering everything that we're discovering because of the 1-2 punch of easy, accessible DNA testing plus the internet has meant that there's a huge number of people who are trying to navigate all of these questions. Can I find anything out? What are the laws? Do I have any rights? And yes, I mean, I feel very much activated, you know, like I began 2 years ago feeling like I would never really become polemical about this and I would stay on the literary side of things. But I do and have become somewhat polemical about the state of the secrecy and the lack of regulation in this country, which I can't get into in 2 minutes, but it's just stunning the way that we are not like sort of prepared for this reckoning that we're in. I mean, I'm going to have to leave it at that, but I will say to everyone who's listening who is grappling with these kinds of issues, you know this, I'm sure, but you are far from alone, and there are a lot of resources and more every day.
We'll be back with season 5 of Family Secrets, beginning April 1st.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.